wanted to surprise you. I think it was the second time I retired over in Columbus. I asked Mr. Hargrove if I could give a sermon. This was a year after I retired. And he said yes. And I said, well, just put down guest speaker, because I wasn't a regular speaker. I said, put down guest speaker. I said, and I said, don't tell anybody, which he didn't. And so people came in there, and everybody that came in the door, they'd run up to him. Do you know who's speaking? Do you know who's speaking? Elders and deacons, and nobody knew. And I find that more people come when a guest speaker is put down. It's sort of like the curiosity thing, I guess. We have more attendance, but for any of you who are disappointed, my apologies. Maybe you were expecting someone from afar today to speak to you. So yeah, I'm ready. I just thought I'd let you know that that's why I did that. As you know, I like my notes up close to my eyes. Without my glasses, I can't read anything. With my glasses, I can't read anything. Without them, I can only look about from here to there. Before I get into the sermon, I just want to say a few words about this particular sermon. You've all heard, and I have too, sermons before the feast about preparing for the Feast of Tabernacles. Well, this is sort of along that line, but this one has to do with preparing for the eighth day of the feast, what we've traditionally called the last great day. And so my sermon's all about that, preparing for the last holy day. I've noticed, and it's not only preparing for the last holy day, for the holy day itself, but also for what that day pictures in the future, preparing for that as well. I've noticed over the years that, you know, we all have our Bibles out preparing for Passover. Come the night to be much observed, I always review Exodus and the New Testament Passover. When Pentecost comes, I'm in Acts the 15th chapter, 2nd chapter, all of that in preparing for Pentecost. And then when trumpets comes, like the other night, I'm always reading 1 Corinthians 15. I'm looking about all the different pivotal things that happens when Christ comes to the earth. How we're changed, Satan's put away already, and God's government comes to this earth. And then on Day of Atonement, same thing. I always, we greet it in the evenings by study. And then on the first day of the Feast of Tabernacles, we have an evening service, so we're all go over all the scriptures having to do with the Feast of Tabernacles and the millennium. But I have noticed over the years when that eighth day comes, people have just worn themselves out in their last day of freedom with their families. I've been there. I've done that. And they just go out, and they're just so tired because they've just, lived that day to the full the day before. And then they come home, and the wife's trying to pack the suitcase to put in the car, and they're just so tired, they never get around to thinking about this day until they sit down in their seats at 10 o'clock the next morning. But all too often, the second service has about 20% less people than the first service. Now, I understand because of age and sickness and all, there's reasons for that. And also, there's other reasons for people with little children or that they could only go to the feast if they didn't go to that second service to get home. But I just thought that how much are we getting out of that last great day and its meaning? And so I decided to give this sermon today about preparing for the last great day. On the last holy day of the feast that we'll be in this coming feast, we'll be focusing our minds on God's plan for those who he has not called during this age. Through a resurrection of physical life on this earth, all who have ever lived will be given their opportunity to inherit eternal life. That holy day pictures the pivotal and personal events to occur on this earth over 1,000 years from now. You and I will be involved in the lives of multiple billions who will be resurrected that time, each and every one of them having a very unique story to tell. With only 60 minutes or so up here today, I can only address one limited but important aspect of what God is going to accomplish through each of us then. And it starts with us seeing our loved ones again after so long a time. And it continues with the ability to help them understand and embrace this way of life that we have walked all these many decades. How much time and thought over your entire converted lives, or your entire converted lifetime, I'll just put it singular, have you given to that future involvement in the lives of your loved ones? What will it be like to see and interact with those we love after so long a period of time? How will we react? How will they respond? None of us has all the answers to questions like these at this time, but I know this for sure. Though a person dies, a relationship doesn't. That relationship lives on in the mind and heart of the one still alive and can be resumed, can be picked right back up again, and in our case will be resumed through the miracle of God's power to resurrect. The most important thing I can assure you of, and that I can flesh out somewhat in this sermon, is that love, your love for your father and your love for your mother, your love for your spouse, son and daughter, and your love for every other friend and family member will not fail to endure in your mind and spirit down through time. And when that time comes, that deep emotional love you have for each of them will be a very powerful force of good in their lives. If you want a title for this sermon, entitle it Love Lasts Through Time. Love Lasts Through Time. Sometimes it's not until we hear or read unique stories about the lives of others that our heart is opened or softened to be able to treasure the meaningful relationships that we have. Oftentimes, real life stories about others help us gain a fuller perspective of things, help us have a more open heart towards loved ones, even loved ones who have hurt us so deeply in the past. I've heard so many stories from minister and member alike since the United Church of God has started, who have experienced fractured relationships with loved ones in their lives. And so in order to help us all gain a more meaningful perspective of this soon coming holy day that we have traditionally called the Last Great Day, in regards to your life and your family and my life and my family, in the bond of love that encompasses those collective lives, I'm going to spend the remainder of this sermon telling or reading you five stories. This is the only sermon I've ever done that where I just tell five stories over the whole sermon. I'm going to spend, again, the remainder of the sermon on that. The central theme of each you can carry with you to the feast along with your own life story, to be reopened at the onset of the Last Great Day. And as you review each story's central theme of people holding on to love through time, let the love of God inspire you to think deeply about your future life with all those loved ones God has given you and how you plan to help them at that time. The first of these five stories was originally published in 1966 in Reader's Digest, and it was called It was featured in a section they had on true stories, and it was called The Voice in the Box, and it was written by Paul Villiard. It's his story of something from his childhood that he wrote down and sent in. It was republished under another name, Information Please. But the story opens on the life of the author as a little boy living in the Pacific Northwest, back in the years when live telephone operators helped customers. This must have been back in the late 40s, early 50s. I remember that, but went out when I was a little kid. So the only reason I brought this flashlight up is this is so small, I don't know. With these fluorescent lights, it hurts my eyes to read them, but I think I can get by. He writes, "When I was quite young, my father had one of the first telephones in our neighborhood. I remember well the polished old case fastened to the wall. The shiny receiver hung on the side of the box. I was too little to reach the telephone, but used to listen with fascination when my mother used to talk to it. Then I discovered that somewhere inside this wonderful device lived an amazing person. Her name was Information Please. And there was nothing she did not know. Information Please could supply anybody's number and the correct time. My first personal experience with this genie in a bottle came one day while my mother was visiting a neighbor. Amusing myself at the tool bench in the basement, I whacked my finger with a hammer. The pain was terrible, but there didn't seem to be any reason in crying because there was no one home to give sympathy. I walked around the house, sucking my throbbing finger, finally arriving at the stairway. The telephone. Quickly, I ran for the footstool in the parlor and dragged it to the landing. Climbing up, I unhooked the receiver in the parlor and held it to my ear. Information, please. I said in the mouthpiece just above my head. A click or two and a small, clear voice spoke into my ear. Information. I hurt my finger, I wailed into the phone. The tears came readily enough now that I had an audience. Isn't your mother home? Came the question. Nobody's home but me, I blubbered. Are you bleeding? No, I replied. I hit my finger with the hammer and it hurts. Can you open your ice box? She asked. I said I could. Then chip off a little piece of ice and hold it to your finger, said the voice. After that, I called Information Please for everything. I asked her for help with my geography, and she told me where Philadelphia was. She helped me with my math. She told me my pet chipmunk that I had caught in the park just a day before would eat fruits and nuts. Then there was the time Petey, our pet carrot, died. Pet canary died. I called Information Please and told her the sad story. She listened, then said in the usual things grown-ups say to soothe the child's but I was unconsoled. I asked her, why is it that birds should sing so beautiful and bring joy to all families, only to end up as a heap of feathers at the bottom of a cage? She must have sensed my deep concern, for she said quietly, Paul, I always remember there are other worlds to sing in. Somehow I felt better. Another day, I was on the telephone. Information, please. Information, said the now familiar voice. How do you spell fix? I asked. All this took place in a small town in the Pacific Northwest when I was 9 years old. When I was 9 years old, we moved across the country to Boston. I missed my friend very much. Information, please, belonged in that old wooden box back home, and somehow I never thought of trying the tall, shiny new phone that sat on the table in the hall. As I grew into my teens, the memories of those childhood conversations never really left me. Often in moments of doubt and perplexity, I would recall the serene sense of security I had then. I appreciated now how patient, understanding, and kind she was to have spent her time on a little boy. A few years later, on my way west to college, my plane put down in Seattle. I had about a half an hour or so between planes. I spent 15 minutes or so on the phone with my sister, who lived there now. Then, without thinking what I was doing, I dialed my hometown operator and said, Information, please. Miraculously, I heard the small, clear voice I knew so well. Information. I hadn't planned this, but I heard myself saying, could you please tell me how to spell fix? There was a long pause. Then came the soft-spoken answer. I guess your finger must have healed by now. I laughed. So it's really you, I said. I wonder if you have any idea how much you meant to me during that time. I wonder, she said, if you know how much your calls meant to me. I never had any children, and I used to look forward to your calls. I told her how often I had thought of her over the years, and I asked if I could call her again when I came back to visit my sister. Please do, she said. Just ask for Sally. 3 months later, I was back in Seattle. A different voice answered, Information, I asked for Sally. Are you a friend, she asked. Yes, a very old friend, I answered. Well, I'm sorry to have to tell you this, she said. Sally had been working part-time the last few years because she was sick. She died 5 weeks ago. Before I could hang up, she asked, wait a minute, is your name Paul? I said, yes. Well, Sally left a message for you. She wrote it down in case you call. Let me read it to you. The note says, tell him I still say there are other worlds to sing in. He'll know what I mean. I thanked her and hung up. I knew what Sally meant. Well, it goes on a little more than this, but this is a beautiful, moving story from a more innocent time that we can draw a few parallels from. Here were two people who amazingly never, ever met each other, just on the phone, but who held on to a special love through a long period of time and who would each carry that love to the end of their lives. The story also illustrates how quickly and thoroughly that relationship was picked up many years later. They picked that right up. Also, the young man was unaware of the short window of opportunity he had, but he did respond to that love in time, right before it would have been too late, and he did respond to the enrichment of both of their lives. We have the same window of opportunity ahead of us. And I think, you know, I give you this story first because each one had a window of opportunity, as we'll see. If strangers can hold on to love through time, how much more can family? The next four stories involve family. And not only that, but people God was calling or dealing with in this age. Let's see, check the time here. I gotta get five stories in here. The second story occurred in the middle to late 1980s on the East Coast. The church pastor and I visited a young woman in her early 30s, and she was already actively living everything that she knew. I mean, she was keeping the Sabbath, holy days, everything. And so the pastor invited her to church that coming Sabbath. She said she wanted to come, but she had already promised a good friend that she would come to her wedding that Saturday. But she said, I will be there the following week. And she did. She came the following week, and she came in. She missed the sermonette, but she came in just at the beginning of the announcements, just in time to hear the pastor mention that a certain man had died that week, and the only one in the room who took it the hardest was this young woman. That was her father. That was her father. He had had her out of wedlock 30-some years earlier, and the mother gave the child away to adoption. And, you know, she sat there. I mean, how would you feel? You come to service the first time, the first thing you hear out of the pastor's mouth is that your father has died. And, I think she even told the pastor and I that she had been adopted, but nobody else knew that. But, you know, she came so close to meeting her real father in the last week of his life, you know. But it must apparently wasn't in God's plan for them to meet in this life. I knew her father. I knew her father for 20 years at this time, knew him very well. And if she had come to church that Sabbath, it was a combined holy day. He was in the North Church. There's only about 60 people. And he was a man who would go out of his way. In fact, you probably know the man because he was in the Baltimore Church when you were there, too. But he would have gone up to her. He was so outgoing, he would have met her. And she looked a lot like him, so I think for sure that she would have met her father. But she had this window of opportunity as well. You would say, well, where's the window of opportunity? Well, the window of opportunity was if she had arrived at church services just a few minutes later than she did, just a few minutes later, she would have never known that her real father had died. She would have never known that he was a member of the church she was now entering. She would have never known that the two young men in our sister church, who she would see and meet at services, were her two half-brothers. And that she would grow very close to them and learn a lot about her father and see pictures of her dad. And she would have never known that her father had searched for her for years and years and years. But the adoption agency told him that she lived in the other part of the state. So he was always for years searching over there for her when she lived down in another part of the state. But again, she would have never known that he had searched for her. And which was proof that he never stopped loving her as well. Okay, the third story occurred in the same church area, in the early 1980s. That's where I attended church. It's the story of my brother-in-law, Ed, and his family. The story really begins during the depths of the Great Depression back in the 1930s, with a young single mother taking her three tiny children door to door and knocking on the door, and the people would come. She'd say, "Can you take care of my children? I am out of work and I cannot feed them." And amazingly, she got three families, three separate families, to take each taking one child in a 40-mile radius. I mean, a 40-mile from north to south, I should say. And I've heard that has happened in other cases. I've read about them during the Depression. People would take other people's children and then take care of them for a while. The only thing here is she never came back. She never came back for them. And, you know, she... I'm getting ahead of my notes here. I do that with this sermon. I pick up the story 40 years later, and a woman about 40 years old, you know, about 40, you start thinking more about your roots and your family. She called the lady who had actually adopted her then when the mother didn't came back. Back in Delaware, she called the lady and said, "Mom, can you look in the phone book and see if there's a person," and she gave my brother-in-law his name, and because she wanted to find him. Well, her mother said, this is her adopted mother, said, "Yeah, there is a man by that name up in Milford, Delaware." Now, if she'd called a year later, she would have never found her brother. He had lived over in Baltimore for 20 years, almost 20 years, so she would never found him. And so, again, this starts their window of opportunity for this one to get moving. And so she said, "Well, give me the number." And she did. She got the number. And she called it right away. And the man answered, which is my brother-in-law. And she said, "My name is Ginger. Are you my brother?" And he said, "Yes." Because they knew each other's names. In fact, I think a social worker had found out about them being left different places. I guess to go for adoption, you have to tell that. And so they did the three of them. There was two boys, and then the littlest one was Ginger. She was a girl, and they did get them together, I think, two or three times when they were real little, and that's it. They never saw each other again. So now here we are, almost 40 years later now, and she said, "Oh, she told my brother-in-law, "I just have to come and see you." She said, she lived out in Missouri. And so, my brother-in-law told her his address. They were going to meet on a Sunday morning in like 2 weeks from then. And, she was so excited. She hung up the phone and she called her best friend and she said, "Guess what? I finally found my brother," she said. She said, "Wouldn't it be something if I got to Delaware and Eddie was in the church?" Here God had called her 20 years earlier. He had called my brother-in-law like 40 years earlier. And, you know, neither of them knowing each other was a member of the church all this time. And so the day came when she came back to Delaware from Missouri, and she went to services. We only had, I think, about 100 people there, something like that at that time. And of all things, she sat in the row right in back of them. My brother-in-law, his wife, and two young girls. She sat in the row right in back, and she was right in front of me. Well, for some reason, Ed and his family just never got to meet her. And but, you know, his mother-in-law did. She sat next to this lady. I got to meet her, and it was just all we knew was a lady from Missouri, you know. And she wouldn't know. Oh, she said later that she remembered sitting there looking at the two girls saying, "Well, from what my brother told me, my nieces are about the age of these two girls," not realizing she was looking at her nieces. And it wouldn't be till the following day when she knocked at that address and my brother-in-law opened the door. You could have knocked me over with a feather, you know, that applies there, that she realized she was looking at her nieces. And they were so happy, and they found out each other was in the church. And it wasn't until that day, you know, that was evident to both of them. And They wanted to find their brother. They had a brother. They knew he had moved to Baltimore, and so they got a detective or whatever, and he found their brother over in Baltimore. And the three of them got together, and they said, wouldn't it be something if we could find our mother? They didn't even know she was still alive. She'd be very elderly. And so what they did is they contacted the Philadelphia Inquirer. That's the biggest newspaper in Philadelphia, and it goes out into all the suburbs. And so they ran it on page one of, I don't know, Home and Family or Family and Garden, whatever it is, Home and Garden, because the reporter was fascinated by their story. And so he ran the whole story on the front page. So to make a long story short, there was a young woman out in Westchester, which is way out in the boonies from Philadelphia, but she got the paper, and she's reading the article. And she said, you know, this sounds like something my mother told me about. And so she took the paper to her mother, and she said, Mom, read this. And here's an elderly lady, and she starts reading this. And I would imagine her hands were shaking. I would imagine that newspaper was shaken as her mind comprehended what she was reading. And her exact words were, she turned to her daughter. She said, these are my children. They're trying to find me. And so she contacted the reporter, the newspaper and the reporter. He got them all together. And it was quite a reunion among all of them. And she did not live that many years after that. So they had a unique opportunity to act on what Ginger got things rolling, you know. And if they'd waited, if she had done it before, she would have never contacted her brother. He didn't live in the state. If they waited too late to contact the mother, try to contact the mother, she would have died. So, again, there's a window of opportunity there. They had to establish a relationship with their mom to the enrichment of all of them. Okay, that's the third story. I'm way ahead of my notes here. You might be sitting there thinking, these are some tall tales old Joe's up there telling us today. But every word is true, and I'll tell you why, because these notes I have came from what I actually was so inspired by that story, I wrote it up for the Worldwide News. And before I sent it in, I sat down with each of them separately, and I said, is this the way it happened? My brother-in-law said yes. And when Ginger read it, she said, yes, that is exactly the way it happened. Word for word, you know, what their mother said and everything. So that's the third of the stories. And I know I'm tugging at your heartstrings in relating these stories to you, but it's important to stop and consider just how deep and lasting that love is that God has engineered into human minds. That was pretty evident to me last winter when I was watching a few segments of a TV show on PBS called Finding Your Roots. I'm sure some of you have seen that. And I think it's on again. But it's a show where they bring to light the family ties of some well-known people. They'll take somebody that everybody knows, and then they'll go back and through their family tree. One person at the beginning of their genealogical journey said, and I quote, I wanted to do this because this is the one mystery beyond all mysteries that I want to know. In other words, what I want to understand. At the end of all the information revealed to these people by tracing their family roots back hundreds of years, sometimes like 800 years or more, back through epic trials and upheavals in these people's lives, in the lives of these ancestors, stories of brutality, stories of famine and war and how they survived it all, how some of them were in pivotal situations where they didn't compromise. Now, there was others where the people, their ancestors, they really wished they hadn't known about them, and some shocking things where their ancestors weren't really their ancestors, things like that. But for the most part, these people were just enthralled because the man would give them a book and they would turn the pages of the book and it would have pictures and all in there. But at the end of those revelations to these people who had known almost nothing about their family tree, they responded by saying things like, and I quote, I'm proud they're my ancestors. Fills in a lot of missing pieces for me. One lady said, now I understand my mom so much more because of the upheaval in the life of her mother, who she would never talk about. And another said, now I know their story. They are a part of my story, and in that sense, I live with them. Another said, they are what I am. That's true. We are what they were in so many ways, because you would see pictures with looks. It would skip a couple of generations, and it would be a dead ringer for somebody that they knew, you know, 100 years or 50 years ago. It skips sort of like through the genes that way, you know. But another said, I wish I could go back and meet them and be a part of their lives. One lady, she was told about all the upheavals in the generations before her and her mom's, and the man said, turn the page and you'll see an actual picture of your great-great-grandmother. And the lady turned the page. She could hardly believe there was a picture of her great-great-grandmother available, and she cried. She just sobbed, and she kept looking at that picture, and she said, I just can't help wonder what these eyes have seen. Many of the people on these programs sob deeply because this kind of knowledge comes with deep emotion. Human love, and especially love of family, is a powerful, powerful thing. It's what preserves a family and binds its members together through joy and heartache, triumph and tragedy, time and distance. You and I just can't turn off that emotional bond of love that God has engineered into our very beings. It's what motivates and drives men and women to search for an entire lifetime to find their real mother and father. It's what filled a broken-hearted mother whose little daughter had been kidnapped to face the TV camera and state with total commitment, I'll search for her until I find her or until the day I die. It's what caused a teenage scuba diver trapped all alone in an underwater cave in the last few precious moments of his life to scratch on his empty air tank, I love you, Mom and Dad. And it's what motivates and empowers you and me in our interactions and plans for our loved ones, now and forever. We'll never let go of them, never. Because of this incredible vision of the future that God gives his people through the last holy day of the season, this eighth day of the feast, so many of us have a deep, deep emotional attachment and commitment to the kingdom of God. The one woman in the genealogy program said, I wish I could meet them and be a part of their lives. She will. She will meet them and be a part of their lives, and so will we. We'll meet all our ancestors. We'll meet all of humanity that's resurrected at that time and have a part in their lives. As an artist, Norman Rockwell could capture so much in his paintings. They were so down to earth and so true to life. He portrayed family life and love like no other artist. And I especially remember one of his paintings, and this is one of his more famous ones, showing a farm boy leaving home for the first time, going off to college. You can tell because on his suitcase it has like a football banner. It says state on it. But he's going off to college, leaving home for the first time because that suitcase was out at the dirt lane right at the main road where the bus would stop. There's so much in that painting. There was the boy's father, a tired-looking, weather-beaten farmer, sitting there with his son on the running board of the old truck, waiting to say his final goodbye when the bus arrived. There was the boy's big old dog that he probably had from early childhood, with its head resting on the boy's leg, plaintively looking so sad as if he somehow knew his master and best friend was going far away and that he would never see him again. Norman Rockwell could capture it all. The wide-eyed innocence on the boy's face, the faraway look in the father's eyes, as if he was either thinking back over his son's life since babyhood or perhaps thinking ahead to all this young man would face in the years ahead and even now worrying about that. Or sometimes it's what's missing from Norman Rockwell's pictures. Where was the boy's mother? You know, had she died somewhere along the journey? Norman Rockwell had a way of capturing the simple sweetness and innocence of life in all those meaningful moments so precious to each of us in our own lives. And each one of his portraits of life said so much. But there is someone who has captured those precious and tender moments of life even better than Norman Rockwell did, and that's the one who created mankind. For the fourth of the five stories this afternoon, please turn to Genesis, the 37th chapter. You can turn there speak here, where God has captured so much of the sweetness and sorrow of life in one epic story for the ages. In all of this world's literature, there is nothing to compare to the story of Joseph. Even when I was a little child in Sunday school, I could relate to this story. I thought it was some story because he and I had the same name. We both had the same name, Joseph. Early in his life, Joseph experienced all kinds of negative things from family members, just like so many today. But even though life was unfair for Joseph, through all of this is the inspiring story of one man's love for his son, the son of his old age, and of that son's love for his father and his family and how that love lasted through time. Now, I know it's a special love between a father and son, and it is for a mother and her daughter as well. I read an article here recently about a woman who in her teenage years was really wild and created all kind of heartache for her mom over and over and over again. But her mother was always there for her, trying to help her. And so when her mother got sick at the end of her life with a terminal illness, this lady actually quit her job, a really good job. I believe she was a writer. But she came home to her mother's home and stayed there for I don't know how long it was till her mother died. And so I read the article here just a few months ago, and I can't really tell you, it was a beautiful article. All I remember was the last half of the last sentence. The lady told about her mother and her life and their lives together and what her mother meant to her. And at the end of the article, she ends, and she said, "And there's no longer anyone left on this earth to love me unconditionally." That says it all. That really says it all. But anyway, here's a story about a father and a son and a special love. Since we all know the story so well, I'll just hit some of the high spots. Or in Joseph's eyes, I guess there were some of the low spots. Let's turn to Genesis 37. I'll begin in verse 23. Genesis 37, verse 23. "So it came to pass when Joseph had come to his brothers that they stripped Joseph of his tunic, the tunic of many colors that was on him. Then they took him and cast him into a pit, and the pit was empty. There was no water in it. And they sat down to eat a meal. Then they lifted their eyes and looked, and there was a company of Ishmaelites coming from Gilead with their camels bearing spices, balm, and myrrh on their way to carry them down to Egypt. So Judah said to his brothers, 'What profit is there if we kill our brother and conceal his blood? Come and let us sell him to the Ishmaelites, and let not our hand be upon him, for he is our brother and our flesh.' And his brothers listened." Sorry, I'm reading these scriptures so fast, but that's the only way I'm going to get in an hour here. If you could imagine, picture this teenage boy, perhaps tied to the back of a camel that was carrying him far away from everything he knew and loved in this life, his mind perhaps reeling in shock and disbelief of brothers who would sell their own flesh and blood. He probably couldn't quite comprehend it. Turn to Genesis 41. We'll read verse 51. Genesis 41. We'll read verse 51. It says, "Joseph called the name of his firstborn Manasseh, for God has made me forget all my toil and all my father's house." Manasseh means forgetfulness or making forgetful. So at that point in his life, this was still a painful memory. And he was trying to blot it all out. And because he had been blessed, at least he had something, you know, right that was going on in his life that helped him do that. It just showed he wanted it all behind him. But God had other plans, and he would have to face that old life again. That old life will come back into his life, as we'll see. Again, it shows there was a lot of hurt and anger all these years later. Genesis 42, verse 2. Genesis 42, verse 2 says, "And he said, 'Indeed I have heard,'" this is when there was a famine, and Jacob's talking to his sons. "He said, 'Indeed, I have heard there is grain in Egypt. Go down to that place and buy for us there that we may live and not die.'" So it says his 10 brothers went down to Egypt to buy grain. Verse 6. "Now Joseph was governor over the land, and it was he who sold to all the people of the land. And Joseph's brothers came and bowed down before him with their faces to the earth." So that fulfilled what his dream was way back. Joseph saw his brothers and recognized them, but he acted as a stranger to them and spoke roughly to them. Then he said to them, "Where do you come from?" And they said, "From the land of Canaan to buy food." So Jacob recognized his brothers, but they did not recognize him. Then Joseph remembered the dreams which he had dreamed about them and said to them, "You are spies. You have come to see the nakedness of the land." And they said to him, "No, my lord, but your servants have come to buy food. We are all one man's sons. We are honest men. Your servants are not spies." But he said to them, "No, but you have come to see the nakedness of the land." And they said, "Your servants are 12 brothers, the sons of one man in the land of Canaan. And in fact, the youngest is with our father today, and one is no more." Skip ahead to verse 19. And so he accused them again of being spies. Verse 19, "If you are honest men, let one of your brothers be confined to your prison house, but you go and carry grain for the famine of your houses, and bring your youngest brother to me." So that he knew who his younger brother was. He was the only other child from Joseph's mother, Rachel. "If you're honest men, let one of your brothers be confined to your prison house, but go and carry grain for the famine of your houses, and bring your youngest brother to me, so your words will be verified, and you shall not die." And they did so. And then they said to one another, "We are truly guilty concerning our brother, for we saw the anguish of his soul when he pleaded with us. We would not hear. Therefore, this distress has come upon us." And Reuben answered them, saying, "Did I not speak to you, saying, 'Do not sin against the boy'? And you would not listen. Therefore, behold, his blood is now required of us." But they did not know that Joseph understood them, for he spoke to them through an interpreter. He was learning a lot about what happened after he left from his brothers as they were talking openly in front of him. And verse 24, "He turned himself away from them and wept. And he returned to them again and talked with them. And he took Simeon from them and bound him before their eyes." Now, why would he take Simeon? Well, we don't know. It's been speculated that Simeon was very cruel to Joseph when he was younger. His father, Jacob, when he gives a prophecy of all the 12 sons, he said, "Simeon and Levi are instruments of cruelty, or have instruments of cruelty," however you want to translate it, "in their houses." So it shows Simeon had some problems, and he probably took it out on Joseph when he was younger. If you can turn over now to Genesis 43, verse 15. Genesis 43, verse 15. "So the men took that present and Benjamin, and they took double money in their hand and arose." So what happens is Joseph puts their money back in their sacks, and they get home and they discover it. So the father says, "Take double money, and here, take some gifts to the ruler of Egypt." "So the men took that present and Benjamin, and they took double money in their hand." And it took a long time for Jacob to decide that Benjamin can go, because he said, "It'll bring me to my grave if I lose him." But they were starving to death at this point. He had no choice. And they arose and went down to Egypt, and they stood before Joseph. When Joseph saw Benjamin with them, he said to the steward of his house, "Take these men to my home and slaughter an animal and make ready, for these men will dine with me at noon." Verse 26, "And when Joseph came home, they brought him the present which was in their hand into the house and bowed down before him to the earth. And he asked them about their well-being and said, 'Is your father well? The old man of whom you spoke, is he still alive?' And they answered, 'Your servant, our father, is in good health. He is still alive.' And they bowed their heads down and prostrated themselves. Then he lifted his eyes and he saw his brother Benjamin, his mother's son, and said, 'Is this your younger brother of whom you spoke to me?' And he said, 'God be gracious to you, my son.' Now his heart yearned for his brother. So Joseph made haste and sought somewhere to weep. And he went into his chamber and wept there." Okay, let's skip ahead to verse 26. Usually I have the others marked. Make sure this is the one. Yeah, 43. No, I'm sorry. No, I must have skipped ahead a little bit. I did skip ahead a little bit. I'm sorry. Okay. Verse 18, Genesis 44:18. I'll just start there. He was going to keep. He accuses them again of doing this to him because they were brought back again. They were brought back a second time, and he accuses them again. It just shows the anger that Joseph had in his heart. He had a love for his family, but he had so much anger that had built up because of what they had done, how they had hurt his dad, how they had hurt him. And so all this is working out through his thinking. Verse 18, and Judah came near to him when he told him that he was going to keep Benjamin this time. Judah came near to him and said, "Oh, my Lord, please let your servant speak a word in my Lord's hearing, and do not let your anger burn against your servant, for you are even like Pharaoh. My Lord asked his servant, saying, 'Have you a father or a brother?' And we said to my Lord, 'We have a father, an old man, and a child of his old age who is young. His brother is dead, and he alone is left of his mother's children, and his father loves him.' Then you said to your servants, 'Bring him down to me that I may set my eyes on him.' And we said to my Lord, 'The lad can't leave his father. If he should leave his father would die.'" And so then he talks about what happened. And so down here, verse 30, it says, "Now therefore, when I come to your servant, my father, and the lad is not with us, since his life is bound up in the lad's life, it will happen when he sees that the lad is not with us that he'll die. So your servants will bring down the gray hair of your servant, our father, with sorrow to the grave." And verse 33, here's what Judah tells Joseph. He says, "Now therefore, please let your servant remain instead of the lad as a slave to my Lord, and let the lad go up with his brothers. For how will I go up to my father if the lad is not with me, lest perhaps I shall see the evil that will come upon my father?" And so here Joseph sees how these brothers have changed in they've grown in family love and loyalty. How Judah was willing to lay down his own life for the life of one of his brothers, and so that his father wouldn't suffer. When they were young and selfish, they did something and they didn't realize the consequences. They did not realize the depth of the love that Jacob had for Joseph and how much he would suffer. And so again, he was able to tell Jacob that, or to tell Joseph that. And so Joseph again is moved by this. And all kinds of memories were flooding into Joseph's mind right then. And indeed, he may have had several more steps planned in this moving melodrama. He may have had a lot more anger, but again, somehow something changed there when he saw what one of the brothers was willing to do. All those years of waiting and longing finally catch up with Joseph. He had cried in private at their two previous meetings, but not this time. Notice Genesis 45, verse 1. Genesis 45, verse 1. "Then Joseph could not restrain himself before all those who stood by him, and he cried out, 'Make everyone go out from me.' So no one stood with him while Joseph made himself known to his brothers. And he wept aloud, and the Egyptians in the house of Pharaoh heard it. Then Joseph said to his brothers," now, before this time, he was dealing with them through an interpreter. They didn't know he spoke Hebrew. But all of a sudden, cutting in his native Hebrew tongue, he says, "I am Joseph. Does my father yet live?" The Old Testament, Old New James says, "yet live." "Does my father still live?" He probably screamed that out. "Is my dad still alive?" You know, that's what was on his mind all these years. And, you know, all kinds of emotions were, you know, going through Joseph at this time. You know, can you picture it? There stood the mighty ruler of Egypt in full regalia, you know, with tears running down his face. No one could know how he felt at that moment, standing before 11 brothers who didn't even know that he was their brother. And, you know, something in his mind, something he had thought about for a long, long time. The love of a father for a son and a son for his father is a very special love, as I mentioned before. And in this case, a love that had been intensified or magnified over a long period of time and trial. In the following chapters, you can read, record some of the most moving dialogue in the whole Testament of how Joseph rode out in his chariot to finally meet Jacob. It's like something out of a movie. You know, you can picture it on the widescreen, you know. He's going out and you can see his father come in the opposite direction. Of how they embraced and cried for a long, long time. Of how Jacob called Joseph to him before he died, and the heart-to-heart talk they had about those things that were so meaningful and precious to the two of them. He told Joseph, he said, "Your mother Rachel died beside me in the land of Canaan." He probably, you know, said, "Your mother died with my arms around her," something similar to that. So much space in the Bible here. In fact, 13 rather long chapters here in Genesis are allotted to this one story, so that we can learn not only about the ups and downs of family life and love, but also about how God was able to take all of these physically and mentally and emotionally shattered lives and so perfectly make them all come back together again into a proper and lasting bond of love, and do it all the while accomplishing several other higher purposes. Two that come to mind is the saving of millions of people from starvation, and giving inspiration and instruction to the people of God all down through the ages, who would see so many parallels to their own lives and their own families. So that's our fourth story, the story of Joseph and the love he carried with him over a lifetime and the window of opportunity where he could finally accomplish so much in their collective lives and bring things, again, this was the opportunity that God had given him. And that brings us to the fifth and final story in this sermon. The fifth story is the one that I have carried in my heart to each and every last great day for the last 54 years. I remember a man who lived and sacrificed for me because he loved me. A man who worked 84 hours a week every week so I could have something better than the fourth grade education that he had. He had to quit school at age 10 because the father had left the family, and he had a lot of siblings younger than him that he had to support, plus his mother, and he had to work in the mines. And at age 10, that was a very hard job for him. My father married very late in life, and so when I was born, he was old enough to be my grandfather, sort of like Joseph, being a child of Jacob's old age. And my father, since it was a child of his late middle age, I guess you'd call it. I had a lot of happy memories, childhood memories, wrestling on the floor with my family, my parents and all, and this when I was really young. But I can remember when I was, by the time I got to the sixth and seventh grade, my father would be reading the newspaper, and he'd say, "Joey, what's this word?" And he'd tell me a word, two, three-syllable word, very simple word. And but since he only went to the fourth grade, he didn't know what that word meant, and I would have to tell him. And I remember thinking back then, I wonder how much he's understanding reading the newspaper. He probably got most of the meaning, but he was missing a lot. I could tell that. But that's my older, younger life. But when God called me at age 14, my family life changed for the worse. Within a year or two, it was outright persecution. I mean, red-hot persecution. I would endure screaming fits. It went on for 20 minutes to a half hour. It seemed like every couple of days. And that went on for a long, long time. I mean, screaming fits were my ears hurt so bad, you know. And when I realized that I was not getting any literature from the church, it took about a month and a half, I asked my mother, you know, "Are you tearing up my literature?" And she said, "Yes, you're not going to get any more of it." Well, within a few days, I was 16 by that time. Within a few days, I was probably the only 16-year-old boy in a city of 86,000 people that had his own post office box. And I used to have to walk 4 miles, though, to get any of the literature, you know. And I made many a trip when I thought the plain truth would be there, and it wasn't. Sometimes I'd walk 3 or 4 days in a row, and you know, till it finally came. You know, you knew about what time of the month that came. But I couldn't begin to tell you all the cruel words and threats that I received in that 16th year. And, disinheritance, running from my life so I wouldn't get a terrible beating, run through the house, jumping off a porch, things like that. But you know what? That was just the new normal. I guess I got used to that after a while. But I remember one thing that really hurt. This is when I was 16 as well. I remember the day my mother sat me down in the living room, and she told me that she and my dad had talked the night before, and that they were going to put me in an insane asylum. Nobody hurts you like family. Nobody else can. Nobody loves you like family, but nobody hurts you like family either. And that really did hurt. They thought I had rejected them, and it hurt them very deeply. I hadn't rejected them. I had always honored them, even with what I went through. I never raised my voice or tried to, shout over them or anything like that. But I always understood from age 16 on that they were doing what they thought was right as a parent. They thought that they were protecting me from something they didn't know and that they didn't like. That's what it was. They thought they were protecting me from that. You would have thought they were more tolerant. My dad was Catholic and my mother was Protestant. So you would have thought they would treat me with more religious tolerance back then. No one has the right to interfere in the religious conscience of another. I mean, this went on into my late teenage years and beyond. They had no right to really interfere with it then, but they did, right to the end of my mother's life, she did that. They had no right to interfere through matters of conscience, matters of conscience in the way they did through force or intimidation. Because we all stand before God. We're all responsible to God when it comes to our own salvation. Nobody else is. And that's almost like a sacred right others should not interfere with, and yet religions have done that all down through the ages, not just people. So at age 21, I graduated from college, and I was offered a job in the Washington, D.C. area at the University of Maryland. And so a few days after graduating, it was time for me to leave home. That day came when I had to go up to my father's bedroom. He was very sick by this time. Cancer had eaten away just about all of his brain. He had very little brain left, and he slept like 22 hours a day. He only got up to eat something and go to the bathroom, but he was very weak. And so when I went in, I had to wake him up and help him up, and it took a while for him. He was like groggy to get up, and I put my arm around him. We sat next to the bed, and he couldn't think of much to say to me. He struggled for a long time to say anything, and finally all he was able to get out was, "Be a good boy." Those were the last words my dad would ever speak to me, and these were words that would stay with me all my life. I can remember driving down to Maryland, and it really didn't hit me that I had left home for good until I saw the sign, "Welcome to Maryland." I remember looking up at that, and just then a duck came out onto the highway with 12 ducklings. You know how they're like an Austrian, it looks like, and they'll follow her. And I had to swerve to miss them. I would have wiped out a whole family of ducks if I hadn't swerved drastically. But, it hit me then that I almost wiped out a whole family. And I started thinking about my family and how precious it was. And I can remember crying so hard that I was afraid I couldn't see to drive. But it really hit me at that point anyways. But anyways, about 4 weeks later, I was down working, and word came that my dad was near death. So I had to drive all night back to northeastern Pennsylvania. I had to go along the Susquehanna River. You could only average maybe 35, 40 miles an hour. There was so many little towns, so it took me all night to get up there. And I arrived home just before 7 o'clock the next morning. I said to my mom, I've got to lay down. I'm so tired. And she said, no. She said, my dad was in a nursing facility in the hospital. It's where terminally ill people were put. He had been in a coma for quite a while. I forget if it was a week or 4 days or something like that. He had never regained consciousness. And so she said, no, we are going right now. We're going right now up there to see him. I said, okay. So As soon as I entered his room, my mother stayed back a little ways. My sister didn't go. She stayed at the house. And I had an older sister. And so I walked right up to his bed. He was laying on his back, and I'm looking down at him. And just then, his eye opened. The other eye never did. But his eye opened, and it was looking straight up at me. And all of a sudden, I've never seen tears gush out of an eye. It was almost like they were under pressure. And he was just looking at me crying. And just then, he took three breaths, and he died that quick. And, I mean, it's something you'll never forget when something like that happens. Like I said, he had been in a coma. And that's the only time I ever saw my dad cry. Immediately, again, he took that three gasps of air and died. And this happened in less than 15 to 20 seconds from the time I entered the room. And so that was my brief window of opportunity to experience something that God wanted me to experience. Almost immediately, my mind was very aware of why my mom insisted that we come there right then. She was very insistent on it, that it was God's doing. It was an absolute miracle in my mind. And I was also aware of the precious blessing of experiencing the last few moments of my dad's life and to see and deeply feel that final expression of his tender love for me. At that moment, all of those cruel words, all those years of searing hurt and harshness just began to melt away from my mind. And I was filled with a hope for the day that he would truly understand the path of life that I had chosen. And I had spent hours that day thinking about the last great day and thinking about what I would plan to do for him when I saw him again. And like I said, I wasn't sad. I just realized that God had given me this very short window of opportunity to see that. That was very important that I saw that. And just to seeing, being there moments before his death is so precious to me. To be there when he's brought back to life will be even more precious. With some of you, it'll be a mate, a mom or a dad. So many others will be longing to see a child who died early in life. As I mentioned earlier, God has engineered into human hearts that emotional bond of love that makes family life so special, so meaningful. Your family, my family. You won't have seen those loved ones for over 1,000 years, but when that time comes, when that hour comes, and that wonderful second resurrection is about to occur, your love for them will bring you back from the furthest reaches of this universe, if necessary, but that love will bring you back to the place where they lay sleeping, as God analogizes it, and I'll let you fill in the rest of all you plan to do at that time. It might be best for me to let others initially deal with my mom and dad. So deep was their prejudice towards this way of life that I think they need to understand what's happened in the whole scheme of things. Somebody else paint the broad picture, and when their minds are, you know, focused in a certain direction, be my time. But again, you can be sure I'll be watching every detail of it from the time they're resurrected. But that day, you know, lots of times I thought even that day he died that I would come as a migrant worker and work on his land. I guess everybody will have a little plot of land. And over the campfire at night, I'd talk with them, and I'd probably do something like Christ did there after he was resurrected. He clouded those disciples' minds, you know. I think I'll have to cloud my dad's mind. But after 54 years, I probably won't have to do much clouding. I look so different than I did back then, you know. And I'm now much older than he is when he died. But again, that day will come when he will hear those words, "I am Joseph, don't you remember me?" And he will remember me. A man can never forget his son, his only son. And a deep relationship that will last an eternity will be renewed at that time. Brethren, there are multiple billions of moms and dads and sons and daughters who now lay in their graves awaiting a future life and love. This world has absolutely no concept to what has happened to their dead or what the ultimate, what ultimately happens to their dead. This world has absolutely no concept of God's plan for all mankind. And this coming holy day on the eighth day of the feast brings that out. We learn more and more each year. They have no concept of God's plan or the fact that there are a people on this earth called the Church of God who are thinking of and planning for some pretty exciting things over 1,000 years into the future, a people who, like those we've heard about here today, are living proof that love lasts through time.